From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our connections with it. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak. Last week, we discussed a story about industrial wastewater sludge in the state of Virginia, allowing it to be disposed of on open farmlands within the state, in fact, as close as 200 feet within private homes or from private homes.
That's right. Interesting stuff. So it got us thinking, what happens to the sludge generated at the wastewater treatment plants here in Summit County? Joining us to help answer this and all of your other wastewater sludge-related questions will be Mike Lewers, General Manager of the Snyderville Basin Water Reclamation District.
That's right. The SBWRD includes the East Canyon Creek Wastewater Treatment Plant. That's the facility which treats nearly all of Park City sewage and manages the sludge generated at the plant. Mike joins us in the first half of the show.
With him, we'll also cover the blue-green algae that has been taking over Lake Erie and its relationship to some of our problems in our watershed right here in Park City.
Ah, it'll be a really interesting conversation.
We also have some news highlights from the past week.
Talking about interesting, what do we got?
That's right. So in honor of Shark Week, we obviously have a piece about an increase in sharks in the New York area. We'll also be talking about a new study showing increased levels of Roundup or glyphosate, the herbicide on the food that we eat.
Right, and some of the Roundup resistant weeds that are are showing up at even greater magnitudes and concerns there in the Midwest. I've got a story about some of the dead zones in the Gulf.
It's
not summer unless you got a story about the Gulf dead zone and red tides off of Florida. All of these related. It's all algae and wastewater. It's going to be a great, great show.
You are in for a treat.
Our connections with and impacts upon the environment, that's what This Green Earth is all about. And it gets started right after these words from our underwriters. Stay tuned.
Hi, I'm Deidre Walsh, and I'm a Recycle Utah board member. Recycle Utah helps keep your groundwater clean. We are here every day to help you properly dispose of toxic waste substances, such as batteries, electronic waste, and styrofoam. Water, clearly worth preserving. Recycle Utah is a nonprofit organization helping you conserve since 1990. Check us out at recycleutah.org.
This is Kelly Miller at Assemble. We are thrilled to be a first-time KPCW underwriter. Assemble offers executive offices that may be rented on a short or long-term basis and an alternative to your local coffee shop in our business lounge, 435-709-7888 or on the web at assembleparkcity.com.
This is Steve Roney with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Utah Properties, formerly Prudential Utah. We continue to be proud supporters of KPCW and are excited to embark on the next era of Park City real estate under our new brand. More info at bhhsutah.com.
Welcome to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show on environmental issues and concepts of sustainability. I'm Chris Cherniak. Nell Larson, co-host across the board. And joining us in the studio is our first guest, Mike Lewers. He is general manager of the Snyderville Basin Water Reclamation District. Mike is actually a frequent guest here at KPCW on other shows, but we're fortunate to grab him this week for kind of an extended conversation about what goes on at the wastewater treatment plant, what goes on with the treatment of the wastewater we generate here in Park City, in particular, or among other things, sludge, you know, because that's one of the major byproducts at the wastewater treatment plant when it's working correctly, right? That's actually what you want to generate. And eventually becomes something that is actually can be reused in some form or some fashion. It's a good byproduct. Sludge, as the word goes, is something that, you know, people are not so excited about. But this is actually a product that is generated at the plant that can be reused. And so Mike is here to answer some of the questions we have about, and your questions too. If you got any questions, you can email them in or text them in or on Facebook.
Or post them on Facebook.
This KPCW, This Green Earth, as we're talking to Mike this first half hour. So, Mike, thanks for joining us on the show.
My pleasure to be here.
So, all right, let's start a quick, just give us an overall sketch. How is this sludge generated at the plant?
Sure. So wastewater is collected throughout the basin in Park City here and flows through a couple hundred miles of pipeline and ends up at the water reclamation facility. At the water reclamation facility, what we in essence do is mimic Mother Nature, and we treat wastewater just like wastewater would be treated if you were to take a cup of it and pour it into a local stream. You know, there's naturally occurring bacteria and microscopic organisms that would consume the organic material, which is basically raw sewage. Mm-hmm. At the wastewater treatment plant, we just mimic Mother Nature, but we concentrate it and we obviously enlarge it. But in essence, we take raw wastewater and we feed it to a large population of living organisms. Some of these are bacteria, some of them are tiny little animals, some of them are tiny little, you know, plants. But in essence, we operate a big farming operation. Mm-hmm. And these organisms convert that organic material to more living organisms. And that's, in essence, wastewater treatment from a simplistic standpoint of view. Now, we do take the wastewater and we treat it further to remove nutrients, which we'll talk about later. But what we do with all these living organisms is that we settle them out. We put them in a big centrifuge and basically spin the water out. And we end up with this material that looks like Play-Doh. It has a consistency of Play-Doh, and it contains all these microscopic organisms. But it also contains the nutrients that we removed out of the wastewater, mm-hmm. and that's the phosphorus and nitrogen, for example. And we currently take about a truckload of solids or biosolids each day down to the Salt Lake landfill, where we work with a company by the name of ET Technology. They take this material and they use it for top cover for the Salt Lake landfill. Because our solids have these relatively, you know, high levels of nutrients, it helps promote grass to grow in the landfill, and it's beneficial for them. And it's a pretty much a beneficial use of the right. of the solids. Now, yeah. At one time, some of the folks that have lived here a long time will recall that we did have a compost operation here in town, where we would take those solids and we would mix them with wood chips, and we'd produce a compost product that we used to give away. That type of an operation does produce odors, and we had problems with that, so we had to shut that operation down. But so currently we're taking our solids to Salt Lake landfill for the top cover.
So what are the other options? Is there a way to use it here in Summit County? Could you spread this on a field like the sludge we were talking about last week, the industrial sludge?
For the last couple of years, we've explored a number of options, including taking these solids to the West Desert and working with a large ranching operation out in Skull Valley, where they would take this material, they'd spread it out on a large asphalt pad, dry it out, make sure all the disease-causing organisms are killed. And then they would take it and they would apply it to rangeland as a organic supplement to the soil. And it worked very well. And we liked the product. The rancher liked the product. The problem was it's 100 miles each way to do that. And it just got to be too expensive.
Too expensive.
But for a test project, it was quite a success for the end product and for the benefit it provided to the rancher. Now, we are involved with Summit County currently. They are updating their master plan, and we continue to explore options here locally. And these might include participating in a compost operation at one of the landfills that the county is currently operating. It could involve taking green waste material, as an example, mixing our solids with that, producing a compost product that would be beneficial to the residents. That's one option that we're looking at. Another option would be for us to take those solids and put them in with the garbage in the landfill. Because our solids does contain quite a bit of water and nutrients, gas production would be elevated, mm-hmm. and that gas could be captured and sold. So there's a number of options that are on the table right now as the county continues to upgrade their landfills.
How much sludge does the plant generate a day? truckload
wine? We have two facilities, and if you add them up together, we produce about 7,500 tons a year. And that will probably double in the future.
So in other places, this sludge or this product is actually marketed as a fertilizer.
It is. Now, a lot of these wastewater facilities will take their solids, and they will process them to what's called a Class A biosolid. And the term biosolid means you have taken a wastewater sludge and you've processed it to meet certain regulations that you can put it to beneficial use. But you can go down here to Home Depot and buy a bag of solids that come out of Milwaukee, and it's a type A biosolids, and you can use it to augment the soils in your garden,
right?
You know, your grass or whatever. And they're completely
that's called Milorganite.
Yes, so that's
the brand
correct.
Name.
All the way.
So, in fact, so that's
the country.
Okay, so that's a material. That's a biosolid that is actually comes from the Milwaukee treatment plant.
That's correct.
System. Okay, so what's to prevent, is there any state prohibitions here that says you can't apply biosolids on a farmland that's growing alfalfa or other vegetable or root crop?
There are a very good set of regulations, meaning that before you apply any biosolids to, say, edible crops, you have to meet a type A. If you want to apply it to, say, alfalfa, that is not used for direct human consumption, you can meet what's called a type B.
Okay.
So, yes, you do have some very tight regulations that you must meet, and this also includes such things as heavy metals and other things that may come from industrial sources within a wastewater system. Fortunately, here in the Park City area, we have very little of that, so that's generally not a concern for us.
But it might be, but I don't think I could apply it to, say, strawberry crops or other types of fruit or for above ground fruiting or like potatoes or carrots. I assume there's probably some limitations.
There are limitations on what you can apply it to and the rate at which you apply it.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So that's interesting. But it's not, so it's going to the Salt Lake landfill, not to the Summit County landfill.
Currently, because again, the Salt Lake landfill likes to receive our solids to help them grow grass on the top of their landfill.
Yeah,
and it's beneficial use. We prefer not to truck it that far, and thus we continue to work with Summit County on other options.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll see what happens.
Okay. All right. So that's one part of the, I guess, what comes out of the treatment plant. You have a solid, a biosolid. In fact, it's not a slow; it's a biosolid material. Then there's the liquid, effluent per se that goes into East Canyon Creek.
That's correct.
Okay. What we wanted to do is talk about what's in that. You talk about some nutrients, nitrogen, phosphorus, and some of the consequences associated with those nutrients being introduced to water bodies. Because that was another one of our stories last week, what happened in Lake Erie. Algal blooms as a result of, in this case, seem like more non-point sources, farmers, nitrogen, phosphorus running off from farmlands, getting into the lake. Algal blooms concentrated at the influent side of the water treatment plant, unable to remove some of the chemicals or some of the toxins released by the algal bloom there in Lake Erie. Toledo's water treatment plant shut down as a result. Panic ensues. Now that's water treatment on drinking water. That's not your side, but you do introduce nitrogen and phosphorus into the East Canyon Creek as a result of treating this water.
We do, and if you'll recall, some 10 years ago, we upgraded the East Canyon Water Reclamation Facility to remove nitrogen and phosphorus down to very low levels, and one of the reasons that we did that is to prevent an outbreak of the cyanobacteria, which used to be called blue-green algae.
Mm.
Now, cyanobacteria are a very ancient organism, and there's a whole slew of species, but they're all in this one particular group. Matter of fact, some of the oldest fossil on Earth is of a blue-green algae or cyanobacteria, which is some 3.5 billion years old.
Mm.
So these organisms have been around for a very long time and are actually responsible for the oxygen that we now breathe on the face of the earth because they were the first bacteria to evolve to the point where they were photosynthetic, meaning that they would take in CO2 and give off oxygen and produce their own food. So it's a very interesting organism, been around a long time, but they do have, at least some of the species, do have this habit of producing a toxin inside their cell. When that they die, they release these toxins, and it can be a big problem. These toxins can, there's different types of toxin, but the type that was responsible for the issue up in Lake Erie was a microcystin, and that particular toxin affects the liver. Now, there are other species that give off neurotoxins that are just as bad. We're not sure, we scientists are not sure why they produce these toxins. It probably had something to do with some evolutionary aspect, you know, maybe millions, even a billion years ago. But nevertheless, what happens is when you have excessive phosphorus and nitrogen in a reservoir or a lake, these algae will overpopulate. And what happened in Lake Erie is they overpopulated, and then the wind blew all these algae right over the top of the intake for the water system. Many of these organisms died. They released the toxin, and they obviously pulled in the toxins into the water system. These type of blooms, as we call them, have become a serious concern where the levels of, again, nitrogen and phosphorus are above, say, natural background levels. When we upgraded the East Canyon Water Reclamation Facility some 10 years ago, we reduced phosphorus levels down to a very low level. And one of the reasons we did that was to avoid a cyanobacteria outbreak in downstream reservoirs. People may not be aware, but some 10, 12 miles downstream from, say, the Jeremy Ranch area, there's a reservoir called East Canyon Reservoir. That reservoir had and it has experienced several cyanobacteria outbreaks. I've seen satellite imagery where, just like Lake Erie, where they overpopulated and this bloom got blown to the side of the reservoir due to a storm. And had there been a water intake at that location, the exact same thing would have happened that happened in Toledo. Fortunately, in this case, there was no direct intake on that side of the reservoir, but there were some cows drinking the water, and it was reported that there were some issues with some of the livers in some of these cows. So it's a very real and serious situation, not only for Lake Erie, but here locally. I will tell you that we are planning to start a design of our Silver Creek Water Reclamation Facility, which is kind of back behind the Home Depot area, to do exactly what we did in East Canyon, and that is to remove phosphorus and nitrogen down to very low levels. And again, the reason we're doing that is to avoid blue-green algae at Echo and Rockport Reservoir.
Okay.
So has there been an issue with the blue-green algae or the cyanobacteria in East Canyon Reservoir since you guys did the upgrade and reduced the amount of
nutrients? Not that I'm aware of. We were only one of many sources of the nutrients to the reservoir. Non-point runoff, meaning water that runs off of golf courses, you know, farms, naturally occurring phosphatic shales and soils can all contribute to this problem. So some 10 years ago, we completed a study, and it was clear that we were a major source of the nutrients. So we took care of that problem, and that's what we'll be doing over at Silver Creek as well.
And let's remember that when you say you want to remove phosphorus and nitrogen from that effluent that goes into the stream, that phosphorus and nitrogen ends up in the biosolids.
That's
just getting put over into the biosolid area, which is good.
Which is where you want it.
Which is exactly because once it ends up in the solids, now we can do something with
it.
But when it's in the water, it's real hard to deal with. And the good news is the technology now exists to be able to take phosphorus and treat wastewater and remove phosphorus to very low levels. It's very expensive, and as an example, the upgrade for the Silver Creek facility will cost in excess of $44 million. So it's not cheap, but it's necessary to protect our natural resources.
Right. Wow.
So is this something that's, you know, regulated that you're required to do, or is this a decision that the organization has decided to take on?
Yeah, we have been working with the Division of Water Quality for about 5 years now on a study of Rockport and Echo Reservoir. And we have jointly funded a study, and we agreed with the state that, hey, if we are a significant portion of the problem, we'll address our portion of the problem, and that's what we've agreed to do.
Okay.
And, hey, but yes, there are regulations pertaining to the nutrients.
Okay. This, yeah. All right. We're speaking with Mike Lores, General Manager of the Snyderville Basin Water Reclamation District. If you don't mind, we're at the bottom of the hour. Let's take a break for a couple underwriters. When we come back, a couple more questions about wastewater treatment. And I want to learn, see if there's anything new in the area of some of the pharmaceuticals and personal care products. Some of the research you've done there is really fascinating. It's This Green Earth. We'll be back right after this.
Hi, this is John with Park City Nursery.
And this is Kay with the Park City Tree Ranch.
Supporting KPCW since 1983.
Between the two locations, we carry a variety of products to help your yard and garden flourish, including living plants, yard art, seeds, bark, compost, and organic products. Park City Nursery. We know what grows. ParkCityNursery.com.
Rocky Mountain Power is proud to support KPCW and This Green Earth. Rocky Mountain Power WattSmart New Homes Program offers incentives for building a new energy-efficient home that can help you enjoy year-round comfort, higher resale value, and lower energy bills. To learn more or find a builder in your area, WattSmart.com.
This is Reese DeMille with Republic Services, your local recycling and garbage service provider and a proud sponsor of KPCW. Summit County residents are recycling more and more each year in their residential curbside recycling bin. Please help by putting acceptable recyclables in and keeping glass out. Thank you, Summit County. SummitCountyRecycles.org.
Welcome back to This Green Earth, weekly talk show on environmental issues, concepts of sustainability. And this week, it's all about wastewater treatment, effluent, and biosolids.
And all of the benefits.
And all the benefits of that, and some of the challenges associated with treating our wastewater here in town. By the way, what are the flows right now? You have huge range in flows at the treatment plant. That's part of your challenge too, isn't it?
It is, because we have to build our reclamation facilities to handle the peak day of the year.
Yeah, and what is that?
Well, generally between Christmas and New Year's, when all the ski resorts are loaded up and everyone's here on their vacation.
Right.
So that's our peak. But I will tell you that the last couple of years, when we have these large events during the summertime, like we did this past weekend, our flows are definitely on an upward trend. Mm-hmm. During the summertime. So we're not seeing quite, you know, one season. We're seeing almost not flat, but it's flattening out in the overall flows.
Kind of a measure of the economy.
It is.
Yeah. Growth in the economy here at set times.
But to answer your question, we have the capacity to treat 6 million gallons a day currently. And we'll be a part of the Silver Creek facility. We'll be expanding that to be 10 million gallons.
Wow. But then on the other hand, say sometimes in April and May, it could be down below where, 5?
Well, we will drop as low as 3.
3? Yeah. So not to get too technical, but it's a challenge for your operators to try to maintain the ongoing treatment, given that wide range in flow.
It's a big challenge. We talked about this population of microorganisms that we feed their raw sewage to. We have to change that population of organisms based on the amount of raw sewage that's coming in, or raw wastewater coming into the system. The food.
Yeah.
The food goes up, we increase the population. As the food goes down, we have to basically harvest, as we call it, some of the organisms.
Yeah. Okay.
Harvest. It is like farming.
Yeah.
that's exactly right. So let's talk a little bit about some of the research you've done in the area of personal care or the chemicals associated with the personal care products, more importantly, pharmaceuticals that are also trending up in their concentrations or in their types in your influent. And then that's also can be a challenge to the treatment plant to try to remove some of these real exotic chemical compounds. What are you finding there?
Well, first of all, the wastewater treatment plants even advanced wastewater treatment plants like we operate have never been designed or were never designed to remove pharmaceuticals or those or personal care product type compounds. So over the last, so we've been looking at this for some 7 years now, we have been sampling the water that comes into the facility as well as water that's fully treated. And we've been looking at these ultra-low levels of pharmaceuticals, hormones, all types of chemicals that are contained in the products that we all use. If you use an antibacterial soap, generally there's a compound called triclosan. That's the ingredient, which is being phased out, fortunately. But think of all the compounds that are in deodorant, shampoos, all of the pharmaceuticals. There's thousands of them. And you take all these compounds together, and they can have a negative impact on the native fish populations here locally. So what we have done is we have been monitoring these compounds, trying to understand what impact, if any, they are having. Keep in mind that the estrogens are a particular concern to us because they can have an impact on, say, the fish and the benthic organisms at ultra-low concentrations. And what I mean by ultra-low concentrations, we're talking about, say, a part per trillion.
Right.
And a part per trillion is tiny. You know, that's, give you an idea, that's like 1 second of time in 317 centuries.
Right.
So it's very small. But our research has shown that when these estrogens are in the treated wastewater, again, at, say, one part per trillion, the male fish will start to be feminized because of these low concentrations. Now, we don't see a problem as long as there's a fair amount of water in the local streams.
Right.
But once the streams start drying up in August and September, didn't happen this year because of the great rains we've had, but in other years where the only water that's in the stream is basically coming out of the wastewater treatment plant, it can be a problem. So we currently have a research project underway this year. Matter of fact, Baylor University, who is working with us on this research project, will be in town next week for 4 days. Hmm. We will be sampling, as we have previously done in the spring, all levels of fish population, benthic organisms from the wastewater treatment system, system facility there at Jeremy Ranch, all the way down the East Canyon Reservoir. And if anyone is interested in watching the sampling, please, you know, give me a call and I can have you arrange that.
And what are you looking for?
We are looking for these pharmaceuticals and estrogens in the adult trout population, say the brown trout.
Mm-hmm.
We also are looking at these levels in the species of fish that they feed on. We're looking at these concentrations in the little tiny benthic organisms that live under the rocks and on the rocks in the stream. And then we want to know how far downstream these compounds exist. Are they being broken down naturally, or are they a potential issue, you know, 10 miles downstream? So it's what we call a temporal spatial study, and we're doing it, this study involves sampling in the spring when the stream flows are high now, and then we also want to do it when the brown trout spawn here in about 2 months.
Hmm. Well, it's really interesting, like you say, 1, 2, 3 parts per trillion to an adult, or maybe even adult fish, maybe not such a problem. But when you're an embryo, it takes on a completely different set of conditions. One compound I'm curious is caffeine. Mm-hmm. Does treatment plants do any effort in removing caffeine? Because I know we pass through a lot of caffeine.
Caffeine is kind of in the same category as these other compounds.
Yeah.
The treatment system was never designed to remove those compounds.
Right.
And we remove very little of it. We do remove some. Now, the good news is that we have conducted a number of tests over the last couple of years to determine if we can, in fact, break down or destroy all of these compounds. And the good news is that, yes, we can. The bad news is that, yes, it's expensive. Currently, there are no state or federal regulations or laws requiring us to do anything. They're not even requiring us to sample because it's a very complex issue.
Right.
If you think of this cocktail of compounds coming down the pipe to our facilities, it changes over time depending on who's visiting Park City. And our cocktail of compounds is different than you might see in Chicago or L.A. So the Environmental Protection Agency is currently looking at this, and they're trying to come up with a way, how do you assess the potential impact of thousands of compounds at any particular wastewater treatment facility, knowing that over time, throughout the year, they change. New pharmaceuticals are constantly being added to the market. So it's a very complex and very difficult situation, because one thing that we cannot do within reason is we just can't go out and take a water sample and analyze for all these compounds. You just can't do it. There's thousands and thousands of compounds, and it would literally take, you know, $100,000 a sample to do that. So we have to come up with a way to like say a bioassay of sorts, where you can run a test that'll give you an idea of the potential impact, and we are currently working with Baylor University and others on some of these bioassays.
But but some of these compounds are, you know, prescription types of whether it's mood inhibitors or compounds, chemicals that address anxiety disorders. You're seeing some of these.
We're seeing all of those, and we talked about estrogens from birth control pills.
Yeah.
About 26% of a birth control pill that is taken for birth control purposes is excreted in urine unmetabolized.
Yeah.
So we see a wide array of compounds coming from urine from everyone that is taking or pretty much eating anything.
Or statins or some other type of
I think issues. You've mentioned like DEET you've been able to
If you apply DEET, say, in your skin and you've got mountain biking like I do, and you take a shower, we can pick up that DEET concentration when we sample, and we have.
That's amazing. Well, I mentioned caffeine because I was part of a study when I was in Florida where we actually looked at water sources themselves, a stream, a canal. We took samples from a stormwater pond. We took samples from drinking water fountains at a public park and groundwater. And the one compound, we looked for some of those exotics, but the one compound we found that was in nearly every one of those things was caffeine. So we are a caffeinated society. And it's,
whether or not we intend to be.
And it's in our water cycle now. And that's the thing that you're starting to see, that these things are getting into our water cycle.
They are. And, we ask people to participate in the drug take-back program or the drug drop-off program that we work with Recycle Utah on. And those are hugely successful. This last one that was held this past spring, I think Enza told me that we collected like 25-gallon buckets of pills. And that is a big, big help because anything that we can keep out of the system will help us protect our local environment. So the takeaway message is, do not flush any unused or expired medicines. Just please do not do that. If you have medicines, keep them until we put on one of these take-back days, or simply drive by the police office here on Park Ave or 224, and they have a black box right inside the front door. Just walk in, you drop it in the little black box, no questions asked, and those pharmaceuticals and things that they collect are disposed of correctly.
I did that. Yep. It's right there. It's right in the lobby.
Good work, Chris.
You don't even have to actually go into the building. It's a separate lobby area, sub-lobby. But this is an amazing thing. My latest edition of Consumer Reports, which is cover story about pharmaceuticals and, you know, the drugged up nation that we are, they recommend on one of their options to flush drugs down the toilet. That's Consumer Reports.
Yeah, we have been working with the DEA and others, because DEA said, hey, on certain class of narcotics, it makes them real nervous to collect them all up and have someone responsible dispose of them correctly. But we are having some new language from the DEA and others to do not flush anything.
Yeah.
Because it you might as well just go out and dump it in the local creek if you're going to flush it. Because, again, even though we have an advanced wastewater reclamation facility, they're not designed to remove these type of compounds.
Yet. So you mentioned that is a possibility. How does that work? How do you get those things out?
We basically take these organic compounds and we chemically break them apart. You can't just cut them in half, because if you cut them in half, you might end up with two things that are worse than the original. So we, what's called oxidation, we oxidize them all the way down to CO2 and water. And it takes a combination of ozone and peroxides and UV light.
Wow. Yeah. Again, involved engineering, expensive, et cetera. But that's where things may be headed.
That's the way things are heading, and especially here in the Park City area, because the local streams have very little water in them during the critical summer months. It's a real issue for us. If you say had a wastewater treatment system that was discharging into, say, you know, the Atlantic Ocean, it's not nearly an issue. But here locally, it is a very serious issue.
Okay. Mike Lors, he's the general manager of the Snyderville Basin Water Reclamation District. Hey, people want to learn more about the treatment plant and stuff. Is a website for that?
Sure. We have sbwrd.org, or just give us a call.
I will. I'm going to be by. Mike, again, thanks so much for taking the time to educate us all on biosolids and nitrogen and phosphorus and blue-green algae.
Fertilizer. Cyanotoxins.
My pleasure.
Oh, you got it. All right, let's take a break for some underwriters. When we come back, it's news time. It's This Green Earth. Stay tuned.
Rocky Mountain Power is proud to support KPCW and This Green Earth. Rocky Mountain Power offers watt-smart advice, such as avoiding the use of large appliances like a washer or dryer between 2 and 8 p.m. because it helps reduce energy demand and keeps costs down for all of us. More ways to save energy at wattsmart.com.
Hi, this is Reese DeMille with Republic Services, your local source for recycling and garbage service, and a proud sponsor of KPCW's This Green Earth. As you recycle, please remember, glass cannot go in your residential curbside recycling bin. Help keep Summit County Recycling clean. SummitCountyRecycles.org.
This Green Earth, we're back, and time for some news items. And the first one we wanted to cover while Mike was still here is
we wouldn't let him leave.
Yeah, because one of the stories is about red tide showing up off the west coast of Florida, kind of the south northwest portion of Florida. It's summertime, and that's not unusual. This is a very large bloom, though, some 800 square miles or so. That's separate from what's going on in off the mouth of the Mississippi, where there's an annual dead zone that occurs from another algal bloom. But Mike, you were saying some interesting things about the red tide. What's that?
Yeah, we talked a minute ago about the cyanobacteria and the toxins that are given off, and the fact that excessive nutrients promote and cause the cyanobacteria to overpopulate. But when it comes to red tide is a different type of algae called dinoflagellates, and these organisms are not nearly as ancient or as primitive as the cyanobacteria, but nevertheless, at times, they will go into a bloom or overpopulate many miles offshore. It might be 60 miles off the coast of, say, New Jersey, and then the wind will blow those algae, and people refer to them as red tide, because the water is generally tinted, but not always red or brown. And then when they die, just like cyanobacteria, they release a toxin that is very deadly to marine organisms. The other thing that's unique about the red tide organisms is that if you have respiratory issues, you do not want to be walking on the beach and be in the vicinity of these toxins, because they do go airborne, and if you have respiratory issues, that can cause you a problem. Unfortunately, this particular toxin that's given off by this dinoflagellates is a neurotoxin, and you may be familiar with the manatees that died a couple years ago. Right. They were eating vegetation that that had a lot of toxins from the red tide, and the manatees basically drowned because these toxins caused problems for their nervous system, and they couldn't control their nervous system, and they all drowned. But the important thing about the red tide is that it may or may not be influenced by, say, excessive nutrients, whereas cyanobacteria almost always is. These red tides will bloom, they'll blow to shore, And if at that point there's excessive nutrients, it may cause the bloom to get a little bit worse, but the excess nutrients did not cause the bloom to start with. And that's a little different than, say, the cyanobacteria we talked about. But the red tide is very serious to the marine organisms and serious to the humans.
Yeah.
So is there any thought on what is causing the red tide? Is it, you know, is it climate change? Is it warmer ocean temps? Is it?
Yeah, there's reports of red tide going back for centuries. And, you know, it can be argued that it's strictly a natural phenomenon that has nothing to do at this point in time with climate change. But as the waters warm, as the acidity of the oceans increase, there are some predictions out there that they could get worse.
Well, this one is, again, off the panhandle of Florida. It's roughly 80 miles long by 50 miles wide, 4,000 square miles. That's pretty big, and it's the largest one since 2006. And like you say, Mike, it's killing fish. And it's actually, they're finding fish being affected, dying at deeper depths, because typically the tide is more of a, I wouldn't say shallow, but it's near surface type of conditions. This one is kind of followed currents down too.
Yeah, so. Red tide can, or the impact of red tide can go very deep, and again, it's a little bit different than some of the others.
That's one scientist with the Moat Marine Laboratory says this is kind of like the marine version of a forest fire. It's an entire ecosystem reset, she says.
I think at one time there was a red tide that was estimated to be 10,000 square miles in size. So they're huge, and the impact to the marine environment in those locations is you know, severe.
Like, again, but that's kind of different from the algal blooms that occur off the mouth of the Mississippi.
That's correct.
Which establishes a dead zone, and I have a dead zone update while we're at it. This is latest year's dead zone. It's an annual event. Again, that's
an annual event.
An annual event. Probably, you know, they might as well have, you know, a weekend for it or something.
Right, a festival. Yeah.
This one's 5,000 square miles. Again, the cause of it is primarily, this is a nitrogen input from the Mississippi, from farms along the Mississippi. They apply a lot of nitrogen, gets into the river gets into the Gulf. The conditions set up, particularly in the summer, warmer water, and you have this massive algal blooms and what's called a dead zone, where the oxygen levels in the water there are roughly less than 2 parts per million. That's kind of the cutoff point that most species can effectively survive in. And that's, do you know what type of algae that is, Mike?
You know, those are typically just normal green algae. And what happens is they overpopulate, they die. When they die, their tiny little bodies, you know, take up oxygen, and they take up all the oxygen out of the water, and now you have this huge dead zone.
Well, that's the interesting thing, too, because when algae is alive, it's actually absorbing carbon dioxide.
Right.
That's okay, but when they die off, they're now consuming oxygen, or the bacteria that's breaking them down is consuming oxygen.
And we've seen this locally, where you have these algae blooms during the daytime, the oxygen will be super saturated. The water's almost boiling, there's so much oxygen in it. But then at night, they go into respiration, or the algae go into respiration, and they use oxygen. And if the populations are high enough, they will cause the oxygen levels to drop below levels that fish need to live.
Amazing. So the article I have is in efforts to obviously get farmers in the Midwest to use less nitrogen, but that's not working well. They need either more stringent state, federal regulations to try to reduce the amount of nitrogen farmers apply to the crops. That's an ongoing challenge. But this is an annual consequence, the dead zones in the Gulf. But there's dead zones all around the world, like you say, Mike, and this is ours. This is the U.S. dead zone.
And I might mention that the Environmental Protection Agency is requiring states to implement nutrient limitations, meaning nitrogen and phosphorus, to address this issue. And here in the state of Utah, the first in a series of limitations is being implemented, and that's the restriction of phosphorus. So while we were required here in the Snydeville Basin to remove phosphorus some 10 years ago, somewhat of a lesser stringent standard is being applied statewide currently.
All right. Again, Mike Lures, thanks so much for everything wastewater and algae. Much appreciated.
Oh, pleasure to be here.
All right. Well, if you want, you're going to hang out. We've got a couple other stories. Now, let's go kind of segue to the Roundup-resistant weeds and some of that. What's going on there?
Yeah. So we're going to start talking about this from, I guess, the point of view of what we eat and what chemicals are on the food we eat. So Norwegian scientists just published a new study that will appear in the June issue of Food Technology showing high levels of glyphosate.
That's the active ingredient.
So glyphosate is the active, ingredient. It's effectively what Roundup is, which is a strong herbicide.
Right.
So Roundup was sort of promoted by Monsanto to be used on large scale. You know, it's like this one hit wonder kind of herbicide. You can use it on everything.
Right.
And then they created Roundup resistant crops so that the crop plant themselves can handle super high concentrations of this herbicide without having any side effects.
So soybean, for example.
Soybeans, for example, corn, canola, sugar beets, cotton, things like that. Massive sort of crops. And so what's happening is that as this chemical is repeatedly applied time after time, year after year, the weeds themselves are evolving to have a resistance to Roundup. And we'll talk about that a little bit more in a minute.
Okay.
But the side effect that has is that then farmers need to put this on more frequently and at higher concentrations.
Right.
So then you have higher concentrations in the plants that are, being farmed, like the soy and the corn and the canola and the sugar beets, that we eat.
It doesn't affect them, but they serve as a store. They store
it. Right. So glyphosate is systemic. So it's taken up by the plant and it's in the plant. And so the EPA has sort of responded to these higher levels in the plants by actually kind of bumping up the level that's allowed to be found on these plants.
Okay.
And so this study detected 9 milligrams of Roundup per kilogram on average. And when you look at older studies, like from 1999, that's nearly double what even Monsanto was deeming extreme, in quotes, at that point. So now with these super weeds that are evolving, the EPA has just raised the allowable residue limits by 200% since that time. And so it's kind of, it's interesting. It's something that can be avoided, though. So this is happening only with GMOs or the genetically engineered crops. If you buy an organic, soy product, that means it hasn't been made with a genetically engineered crop, which means this kind of product can't be used on it. So there are ways around it, just something to be informed about. Other places are taking action on this. Vermont just passed mandatory GMO or GE labeling. Internationally, the Dutch government has decided to ban the sale of glyphosate entirely. Other places are looking at banning it to be used on lawns. Look at alternatives, maybe alternative farming methods. So it'll be really interesting what will happen.
But this treadmill gets set up where the farmer has, like you say, has to apply either more of it at a greater number of times during the course of the growing season to keep up.
Right.
But the EPA, you're saying, is also increasing the allowed limits.
So
Which Monsanto said was okay.
Right. Back in 1999, they said these kind of levels were extreme.
And for Monsanto to say that, that's
Monsanto is evolving as well, it turns out.
Wow.
And so just to kind of make the connection to environmental health or personal health, glyphosate, there's research going on about impacts that it has on people, and it has all, kinds of potential impacts. One 2014 study showed that glyphosate levels was significantly higher in the urine of chronically ill people compared to healthy people.
Wow.
So it may have an impact on a lot of different fronts. This is one of the same things we're talking about with Mike. These are in our system. We're, in our bodies, in our water.
I'm Roundup resistant.
Yeah, exactly. Or maybe unfortunately not.
Or not resistant. Because there's an article in today's New York Times that kind of segues to that with some of the resistant weeds, super weeds that are affecting some of the Midwest crops. EJ?
Yeah, so one of the big things they're calling these weeds is the Terminator, which is that's a great name.
Because it won't die.
It won't die. It just keeps coming back. So farmers are they're putting the Roundup on it. They're putting the like the best pesticide they can, and nothing is killing it.
It's called the Palmer weed.
It's called the Palmer weed. Is what they're calling it. They have a lot of names. It's called the Careless Weed, the Palmer Weed, the Terminator. Mm-hmm. It's got a couple good names. So a lot of soybean farmers and even some places where there's cotton, they're having to go to really old ways of getting rid of weeds, which is basically just pulling them out.
Right.
Which is a lot of manual labor, a lot
so,
of time.
So we're cycling back.
And it's next to impossible.
Next to impossible, yeah. Especially with
as you guys have experienced at Swanner.
Right,
by
exactly.
Trying to do in labor intensive efforts to pull Dyer's Wood or so.
Exactly. You and put hundreds and hundreds of hours in, and that's just not enough.
That's just okay. So here, with respect to the Palmer weed, no amount of Roundup is killing this weed. Well, so now they have to find alternatives, which could be alternative herbicides.
Exactly. So they have to figure out something else because what's working now is really actually not working because these weeds are resistant to it. They think they kill it off and then the next day they come back and it's right there again. So they're going to have to go to different herbicides. They're going to have to go to manual labor. They're just going to have to go back to the old ways and see what works and see if they can try to, you know, make those ways a little bit better.
Wow. Okay. Mm. So, but you know, this is not the end game. This is the end game that doesn't surprise us because we all kind of knew that again, this treadmill that you get put on with any chemical that's called evolution, right? Plants evolve, plants adapt, and eventually they become resistant.
Right. As do, you know, pests, insects, things along those lines. And this kind of gets back to like the farming system as a whole. What are the methods we're using? You know, we're doing these massive monocrops, massive areas of one single plant. And, you know, thinking about rotating crops, using different kinds of techniques. Maybe in the long run we'll be more successful.
Right. Maybe. Well, Swanner, you guys don't apply chemicals to control your weeds.
We do, yeah.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, we do. And we do every year, and we try to keep it to a minimum, and we apply it in places where there are certain kinds of infestations. Okay. We pull everything.
But it's a controlled effort.
Exactly.
It's not a crop duster.
Oh, gosh, no. Yeah, it's a backpack spraying operation.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Right. Point by point. Okay. Mm-hmm. But that's part of your challenge too. That, you know, it's integrated management programs are like that.
Right. Okay. Right. When I started working in the weed management program at Swanner, I thought, oh, we'll never use chemicals. But in reality, you have to if you want to maintain your native plant population.
You know, that's the reality. Okay. That's a great way to end.
Right
now. Okay. Let's do a couple more underwriters and then when we come back. It's time to wrap up. It's This Green Earth. Stay tuned.
This is Dana Edwards on behalf of Vail Resorts and Cannons Resort supporting KPCW. This year, we developed partnerships with 25 local nonprofits to support programs like the fourth grade program at Swanner Preserve and Eco Center. Every fourth grader in Summit County will experience Utah's ecosystem firsthand and see science come to life through in-field classes. Thanks to Swanner for making science cool.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Long Reimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-LAW.com. Park City Nursery. We know what grows. ParkCityNursery.com. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
All right, it's This Green Earth. Time to wrap up, but it's Shark Week now. What do you got?
We've got a shark fact. The number of sharks and whales is actually increasing off the coast of New York and New Jersey. This year, the monitoring group has already counted 29 whales, which is up from 43 for the whole year last year, 25 in 2012, and only 5 whales and sharks in 2011.
That's great. And along those same lines, I read an article that shark fin soup is becoming less popular in China.
There you go.
And so the number of sharks that are being killed just for their fins has dropped dramatically.
In this case, they think the increase is due to cleaner water that's bringing in the kind of food, you know, fish and krill and things that these animals are looking to eat. So it's a good sign for the environment.
All right. Hey, speaking of good sign, let's thank our underwriters. They include Recycle Utah, Republic Services, Vail Resorts, Rocky Mountain Power, San Francisco Design, and Berkshire Hathaway Home Services.
And as always, you can join us on Facebook at KPCW This Green Earth, or you can email us your thoughts, comments, questions to thisgreenearth@kpcw.org.
This is 91.9 FM KPCW in Park City. Here's NPR News.